Hello and welcome back. Now that we've reached the point where Greek independence has come to an end, it's appropriate to pause and ask the question, how did this state of affairs come about? The answer to that isn't just based on how the Greeks and the Romans fought on the battlefield, though obviously that played a major part in the outcome. But it also has to do with how the Greeks conducted themselves off the battlefield, both in their dealings with the Romans and in their dealings with one another. Paradoxical as it may sound, warfare is the defining hallmark of a so-called civilized society, a society that is disciplined, organized, and hierarchically structured. Or as the Greek philosopher Heraclitus, who lived in the 6th century BC, put it more memorably, war is the father of all things. Warfare was the normal state of affairs in antiquity in the sense that as soon as the wisteria began to appear in the Forum in Rome or the orange blossom in the Agora in Athens, the Greeks and the Romans donned their armour and went off to fight war. In the Res Gestae, the document which Augustus promulgated on his death in AD 14 and which records his achievements, the meaning of the Latin, the emperor tells the Roman people that from Rome's foundation in 753 BC, right down to the date of his own birth in 63 BC, there were only two occasions when the city was not at war. Augustus, by the way, who took great pride in the fact that he succeeded in pacifying the Roman Empire, points out that during his principate, 27 BC to AD 14, the gates actually were closed three times. The very first glimpse that the Greeks offer of themselves is in the guise of warriors. It comes in the Iliad, composed around 725 BC, which covers a period of 10 days only in the 10th year of the siege of Troy. The poem begins with the description of a plague that has been inflicted on the Greek army by the god Apollo, who is outraged by an insult to his priest perpetrated by Agamemnon, the Greek commander-in-chief. It ends with the burial of the Trojan prince Hector, after his father Priam, king of Troy, has supplicated Achilles for the return of his body. One of the most affecting scenes in all of literature, in which Priam grasps the hands of Achilles, as we're told, hands that were dangerous and man-slaughtering and had killed so many of his sons, and they both weep. A reprieve from all that carnage, but only a temporary one. After Hector's funeral, it will be business as normal, which is to say, warfare as normal. And we, the Greek audience, listening to Homer's poem, or later reading it, know full well that Troy's fall is predicated on Hector's death, and that after Troy's fall, all the men will be slain and the women and children sold into slavery, as was characteristic in Greek warfare. But it is Hector or Hector's body that claims the last scene. The poignancy of death in battle was a subject very close to the Greek heart. In the archaic period, the most prestigious grave marker was the statue of a naked standing youth. The image is known as a kouros, which is the Greek word for youth, and such markers were often placed over the graves of young men who died in war. Art immortalizes not only their sacrifice, but also their vigor and beauty. And coincidentally, statues of naked youths also represented the god Apollo, the god who emblematized the young man at the height of his powers. And if we don't know the fine spot, that's to say where exactly they were found, and unless they carry an inscription, it's impossible to tell whether they are intended as a votive offering to the god or as a grave marker. Their sculptural ambiguity speaks volumes. No other poem in the Western canon provides a richer or more profound insight into war than the Iliad. There's no comparable Roman work. Virgil's Aeneid probably comes closest. The difference is that Homer clearly had first-hand knowledge of the battlefield, as indicated by his obsessive fascination with how the body responds to missiles and blades entering it at various points, something that Virgil largely ignores. Before attempting to explain why the Greeks invariably lost to the Romans in battle, I'd like to offer a brief introduction to the composition of Greek and Roman armies, since most of their encounters, a notable exception is the Battle of Actium, were land battles. In the Greek world, in classical times, it was citizens who made up the military. In Athens and elsewhere, service in the army and in the navy was both the responsibility and the prerogative of citizens. This meant that Greek armies were citizen militias whose soldiery were called up to serve for at most only a few months in the year. Until the rise of the mercenary in the late 5th century BC, soldiers were amateurs who returned to their homes at the end of the campaigning season. Which of the forces you joined, the cavalry, the infantry, or the navy, depended wholly on your economic status. Those who could afford to own a horse served in the cavalry. Those who could afford to purchase a suit of armor became hoplites. Those who couldn't served as rowers in the navy. The exception was Sparta, whose citizens, known as the homoioi, or equals, were fully enrolled in the army from age 20 to 60. Only in times of crisis, the Greeks enlisted slaves. In early Rome, too, service in the military was a privilege reserved for the citizenry, with the wealthiest, again, serving in the cavalry. The Romans also employed non-citizens as auxiliaries. Auxiliaries formed separate units in the army, but were not regarded as crack troops. The biggest difference with the Greek world was that those without property, the capitae censi, as they were called, the ones assessed by a headcount, were excluded from service. As a result, increasingly in the second half of the 2nd century BC, Rome's military obligations stretched her capacity to the limit, so that in 107 BC, when Rome was facing invasion from the Gauls, a general called Caius Marius took the radical step of solving the manpower crisis by enlisting volunteers from the property-less class. Though this solved the problem temporarily, it had a serious knock-on effect down the road, since Roman legions increasingly came to owe allegiance to their military commanders, rather than to the Roman state, since it was he who recruited them and he who provided them with land on their discharge. It was this transference of allegiance to the military commander that played a major part in the breakdown of the Republic. It ultimately led to the civil war between Julius Caesar and Pompey in 49 BC, both of whom, in essence, owned private armies. The Romans only developed their navy under duress, first to defeat the Carthaginians, who were a naval power, and later to fight wars in the Greek East. You may recall the famous scene in Ben-Hur, which depicts Roman galley slaves wearing leg irons, pulling on their oars to the point of collapse. It's great cinema, but it's actually not true. No doubt a few condemned criminals did occasionally end up as galley slaves in times of dire need, but most of the rowers in Rome's navy were auxiliaries. What was it like serving as a Greek hoplite or as a Roman legionary? There's nothing comparable to the red badge of courage or All Quiet on the Western Front to help us answer that. There's no personal account written by a hoplite or a legionary, no letters sent back home, nothing that sheds light on the conditions of the military. We do, however, have two works, one Greek, one Roman, written by chiefs of staff, so to speak, that shed light on the day-to-day running of a military campaign. The Greek word, called anabasis, or the march up country, is by a mercenary called Xenophon. Xenophon and a force of about 10,000 mercenaries sustain a defeat in which their paymaster, a Persian prince called Cyrus, was killed. Against all the odds, however, they succeeded in marching up country, hence the title of the book, through enemy territory before making their way to safety on the shores of the Black Sea. The nearest Roman equivalent, in terms of its descriptive power, is Julius Caesar's Commentaries on the Gallic War, which records his day-to-day struggles against an enemy that was many times his superior. Since both are written in a crisp military style and with a very limited vocabulary, it's no wonder that they are often the first works of Greek and Latin that anyone learning these ancient languages first encounters. There's one other source that is at least equally valuable for the imperial period, namely Trajan's column. The Emperor Trajan had the column erected in AD 113 to commemorate his victory over the Dacians, a people who inhabited the loop of the lower Danube River. Over 38 meters in height, it stands in the new forum that he built near the Quirinal Hill. It's decorated with a helical frieze, 200 meters in length, carved in low relief. The frieze depicts scenes of everyday Roman military life during the two Dacian campaigns which Trajan fought in the early years of the 2nd century AD. It's an invaluable source of information for Roman arms and armour and methods of fighting. There are over 2,600 figures, two-thirds life-size. Incidentally, the spiral staircase inside the column is one of the marvels of Roman engineering. With this background in mind, we turn to the central question of this lecture, which is why the Greeks were defeated by the Romans. Let's begin by reviewing the major victories of the Romans over the Greeks. Number one, the Romans beat Pyrrhus, king of Epirus, at Heraclea, Ausculum, and Malventum in the 270s, when he had the temerity to cross over from Greece and involve himself in the affairs of southern Italy. Number two, they beat the Macedonian king, Philip V, at Kynoscephaly in 197, thereby breaking up the control that he exercised over mainland Greece. Number three, they beat the Seleucid king, Antiochus III, at Thermopylae in 191, and again at Magnesia the next year, after he had tried to occupy the space vacated by Philip. Number four, they beat Philip's son, Perseus, at Pydna in 168, thereby putting a halt to his imperialistic ambitions. Number five, they devastated Athens and the port town of Piraeus in reprisals for the ill-judged support the city had given to Mithridates VI of Pontus. And finally, six, they beat Cleopatra VII, Queen of Egypt, who had sided with Mark Antony at Actium. Well, actually, she sailed away without giving battle. So, does this mean that the Greeks were girly men, to borrow a phrase, immortalized by the governor of California? Not at all. Just think of the 300 Spartans who fought to the last man against the Persians at the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC. The Spartans were as brave as any fighters the world has seen. There's a famous remark that a Spartan mother supposedly made to her son as he was going off to war. With it or on it, what this means is that he should return either alive with his shield, not having thrown it away to hasten his retreat if the army was beaten, or else he should be carried back home dead on his shield. And the only Spartan males who had their names inscribed on gravestones were those who died in battle. It wasn't only the Spartans, of course, who fixated on war. The Greeks in general were irrepressibly bellicose. Most Greek cities went to war about 3 years out of every four, and their wars, make no mistake, were extremely deadly. Take the example of Athens, which has provided us with documentation of this fact in the form of what are called casualty lists, lists in the form of inscriptions, which cite all the Athenian dead, tribe by tribe, on an annual basis. Scholars have calculated that 3% of the entire Athenian population, on average, died per year. Just think, too, of Alexander the Great and the vastness of the empire that he acquired in the 11 short years that he campaigned. He was never defeated in battle, even though he was heavily outnumbered by the Persians. The nucleus of his army, although it also comprised a large corps of mercenaries, was the Macedonian infantry and cavalry. They were far better trained, far more effective than anything that the Persians could throw against them. The infantry fought as a phalanx, that's to say, in close-packed formation, with a 19.5-foot-long pike known as a sarissa. However, the important point is that Greece's glory days, her victories over the Persian invaders, and Alexander's defeat of the Persians in their own homeland, had taken place long before the Romans appeared on the scene. Let's take the military might of the mainland states. That had been quashed centuries before they came into contact with the Romans. The Spartan army, which in its heyday had been feared and respected as no other Greek army before or since, was effectively defunct by the early decades of the 4th century BC. Its decline had begun almost immediately after Sparta defeated Athens in the Peloponnesian War in 404 BC. The major reasons for its decline was Sparta's lack of manpower, oliganthropia, to give its Greek name. In 480, the year they faced the Persians at Thermopylae, the Spartans had been able to field a force of 8,000 homoioi, or equals. By 371, that number had dwindled to about 1,500. Increasingly, therefore, the Spartans came to depend on non-Spartiate troops to make up the numbers. a fact which seriously undermined both Sparta's reputation and her fighting strength. Almost as a last resort, King Cleomenes III took the radical step of liberating Sparta's slaves, the Helots, in an effort to beef up the military, but it was all to no avail. His army was massacred at Salacia, just outside Sparta, in 222 by Antigonus III Doson of Macedon, an event which effectively marked the end of Sparta as a military power. Much the same was true of the Athenians. Despite their defeat in the Peloponnesian War in 404 BC, they had managed to resurrect a maritime confederacy in 378. The confederacy lasted barely 20 years, however. Several of Athens's most powerful allies revolted in what is called the Social War. And by 354, all that remained in Athenian possession was, in Aeschines' memorable phrase — Aeschines was a prominent politician — a few wretched islanders. Athens was defeated by Philip II at Chaeronea in 338, along with the Spartans, by the way. Then, in 322, her navy was defeated by the Macedonians at Amorgos, an island in the Cyclades, by Macedon. Henceforth, it was the Hellenistic dynasts who mainly ruled the Aegean, until, that is, the Romans appeared on the scene. Though it's perhaps a moot point as to what would have happened if, say, the Romans had encountered the army of Alexander the Great, the historian Livy actually deliberated this question at some length, engaging in what we would call today counterfactual history. Not surprisingly, he concluded that the Romans would have won hands down, even if confronted with, and I quote, 1,000 armies more formidable than those of Alexander the Great. He then goes on to enumerate all the many successful Roman military commanders that he can think of, as well as to do all he can to vilify Alexander's base and ignoble character. Well, he was writing in the age of Augustus, and it wouldn't have done to have been unpatriotic. However, he does usefully point out that the large oblong shield used by the Roman legionary provided much more protection than the small round Macedonian target carried on the arm. And further, that the Roman javelin, or haster, when thrown, landed with much more force than the unwieldy Macedonian sarissa. He also points out that the Roman battle line was much more flexible and manoeuvrable than the Macedonian phalanx. Apart from the fact that Romans were able to put out a far more effective and larger fighting force than the Greeks, there were political, social, and economic reasons why the Greeks failed to withstand the Roman advance, and it's these that I'm going to discuss next. They are, I believe, equally important. First, the Greeks utterly failed to grasp the objectives of Roman policy. When Flamininus made his heart-stopping declaration of Greek freedom in 196 BC, there was an expectation on the Roman side that the Greeks would be duly grateful and thus loyal and supportive to the Roman cause. The Greeks, by contrast, took the pronouncement to mean that the Romans weren't going to interfere in their affairs anymore, and that they were now free to indulge in their favourite centuries-old pastime, endless internecine warfare. This was a fatal misreading of Roman intentions, and one which had disastrous consequences for the Greek world, as we've seen. It's against this background of mutual misunderstanding that we have to set such horrific events as the destruction of Corinth, which would otherwise seem inexplicable. The Greeks consistently sought to disturb the status quo by siding with whatever power held out the promise of throwing off Rome's yoke. And eventually, Roman patience ran out. It's difficult to be entirely sympathetic towards the Greeks. Second, Hellenistic monarchy was no match for Rome in a number of ways. First, Hellenistic dynasts failed to arouse anything remotely resembling the same patriotic fervour that the Romans gave to Rome. To begin with, their claims to legitimacy were shaky at best. What diminished the potency of their cause even more was the fact that they were very dependent on mercenaries. The Romans were also reliant on mercenaries, but to a much lesser extent than the Hellenistic dynasts. Number two, as a political system, Hellenistic monarchy was highly defective. Let's just take Egypt for a start. Egypt was in a state of near anarchy when the Romans moved in, with a sizable part of its population close to revolt. In addition, the Ptolemaic royal house was losing its grip over its own bureaucracy. Also, there was a lot of racial tension in Egypt. We hear, for instance, of a camel driver who hasn't been regularly paid and who claims this is due to the fact that, I quote from a papyrus, we're most fortunate in having papyri for Egypt, "I am a barbarian and don't know how to behave as a Greek." The Greek word is Hellenizein, to behave as a Greek. The clear implication is that non-Greeks were getting a raw deal. And dynastic squabbles caused further problems, as between Cleopatra VII and her younger brother, Ptolemy XIII. The third reason why the Greeks failed to withstand the Roman advance is that the Romans took the view from very early on in their history that war should serve an enduring purpose. It should A, promote the spread of Roman values and the Roman way of life, and B, shift the balance of power in a region once and for all. This meant, in consequence, that the subjugation and pacification of the outside world was both a constant objective and a structural part of the Roman attitude to war. The goal of any aspiring Roman aristocrat was gloria, which means specifically military glory. Gloria was the reward for virtus, a word best translated as manly courage. Vir, its root, means a man, placed in the service of the patria, the fatherland. The highest achievement by any Roman was the award of a triumph. To claim a triumph, however, a general had to have been hailed imperator by his troops and to be able to demonstrate that those troops had slaughtered at least 5,000 of the enemy. Virtually the entire population of Rome would turn out to witness the spectacle. The triumphator drove in a chariot driven by four white horses. Lest it all go to his head, a slave rode beside him in the chariot, repeatedly saying to him, "Remember, you're immortal." Interestingly, the Latin word triumphus, meaning triumph, comes from the Greek word thriambos, meaning a hymn to the god Dionysus, though there was no equivalent to the triumph in the Greek world. No general was more ruthless in his taking of enemy life than Julius Caesar, the conqueror of Gaul. On the basis of the figures that Caesar himself provides, Plutarch calculates that during his 8-year term of office in Gaul, he killed 1 million and enslaved 1 million others. Well, no doubt Caesar was exaggerating. Nobody in antiquity could keep an accurate tally of the enemy dead. But the fact that he exaggerated is evidence of the degree to which he considered such huge loss of life to be fully justified, and evidence, too, of the degree to which he held the Gauls in contempt. At the very end of his commentaries on the Gallic War, Caesar describes how, after capturing the stronghold of Uxellodunum, he decided to make an example of the townspeople by cutting off the right hands of all those who had fought against him. For the Greeks, by contrast, war was primarily an instrument for temporarily settling local differences, or in the case of the Hellenistic dynasts, a means of acquiring an empire. There was nothing equivalent to a triumph, as I said, largely because the overwhelming majority of the wars they fought were against fellow Greeks, the major exceptions being the Persian Wars and the campaign of Alexander against the Persians and the ill-fated wars against the Romans. Most Greek wars were about posturing, about strutting your stuff, a bit of land won or lost. And the victors would also have the satisfaction, at least temporarily, until the next campaigning season, of having settled a long-standing grievance. The goal was a setting up by the victors of a trophy on the battlefield and earning the right to say Yabu sucks to the enemy. If it was a really important victory, like the victory which the Athenians won over the Persians at Marathon, they would erect a small temple at Delphi to house the spoils they had taken from the enemy. By the way, the Greek word for grievance is thonos, beautifully onomatopoeic, I always think. It's a word to spit at someone. Not perhaps unconnected with this attitude to war is the fact that a truce was called for the duration of the Olympic Games, that were celebrated every 4 years. It enabled both participants and spectators to travel safely to attend the Games. Even during the Peloponnesian War, the Olympic truce was adhered to. It indicated symbolically that war took second place to the worship of the gods, which was not the case in Rome. Just like the Romans, however, the Greeks were capable of perpetrating what we would call today war crimes. And in the Iliad, when Achilles kills Hector, he ties his body to his chariot and drives the chariot round the walls of Troy, while Hector's horrified parents watch on. When a city was captured by siege, it was common practice to slaughter all the men and to enslave the women and children. Even more unconscionable was the punishment meted out by the Athenians to the inhabitants of the Cycladic island of Milos in 415 BC. The Melians had committed the unpardonable error of refusing to join the Athenian maritime alliance and remaining neutral in the Peloponnesian War. Athens overpowered them and then carried out what we would call today selective genocide, executing all the males of military age and enslaving the women and children. Thucydides makes much of this incident in his History of the Peloponnesian War, his point being that war, if waged uninterruptedly, has a brutalizing effect upon the combatants. He actually inserts a completely fictitious dialogue between the Melians and the Athenians in which the Melians defend their refusal to join the Athenian alliance. In return, they are treated to a no-holds-barred lecture in Machtpolitik. By contrast, when the Spartans defeat the Athenians in 404 BC, they resist pressure from their allies to destroy Athens. They do so, however, on grounds of self-interest rather than humanitarianism. They shrewdly calculate that the destruction of Athens would destabilize the Greek world and leave them, the Spartans, more vulnerable to their former allies. Following the final showdown with Mark Antony at Actium in 31 BC, the Emperor Augustus brought all the legions under his exclusive control. He also created, for the first time in Rome's history, a professional standing army. He established the army at around 28 legions. A legion consisted of between about 4,500 to 6,000 men. The Roman army continued to evolve in the late empire. Two important developments were, one, the introduction of small mobile units that could be dispatched swiftly to centers of disturbance, and number two, the conscription of German prisoners and volunteers into the ranks of the soldiery. To sum up, the Greeks lost to the Romans partly because they failed to comprehend Roman motivation and dedication, partly because the Romans were a more efficient military machine, partly because they failed to grasp Rome's unshakable determination to bring stability to their region, and partly because of their endemic factiousness and particularism. In the next lecture, we will see how Greece's defeat played out in terms of its impact on Roman culture, where, paradoxically, the vanquished Greeks now became the undisputed victor.